Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you. And thank you. My name is Wayne Thompson, and as I was listening earlier at Harold Taylor talk about New Orleans, I was mindful, he said, well, you know, as they were torturing him, they did not have an opportunity to be visited by any lawyers or any, they had no legal representation at the time. And, you know, he said, so until this guy Wayne Thompson came down to New Orleans. Well, that was quite, that's an interesting story. And this was 1973, and I'm 3 years back from Vietnam, investigative paralegal for a law firm in San Francisco. One day I get a call from some frantic folk in San Francisco saying, please, we need to talk with you about something that's happening in New Orleans, and they're trying to kill our brother and John Bowman. So as being bright and smart, I wind up in New Orleans. No one else would take this assignment. I went down to New Orleans to coordinate the activities to develop a writ of habeas corpus to bring these brothers from the parish prison. And I think I was the first person to have seen the evidence of the torture, because I was a judge, the first federal magistrate there, who named Collins, did a court order ordering the folk at the parish prison to allow me to interview these brothers. So I had an opportunity to see Reuben, as well as John, and one other person. I saw Gina Mosley, who was one of the folk that were also in prison at the parish prison, as well as Harold Taylor. And it was obvious that they had been tortured. And prior to, this was not a secret, because as I was waiting at the parish prison, all of the inmates said, were talking to me, saying, walking past the trustees, saying, I'm really glad somebody's here. We can't sleep at night. These folk are keeping us up, yelling and screaming, and they're torturing, and nobody has been to see about these men. So and I say that to say that it was not as if it was a big secret. And one of the things that I wanted to always be mindful of, Michael mentioned and Bill Whitman mentioned the fact that these things need not be kept secret. You know, we need to speak out. And the other inmates in the parish prison knew what was taking place. The other folk who worked at the parish prison knew what was taking place. In addition to the San Francisco police, there were police officers from New York, there were police officers from Los Angeles, and there were FBI agents there. And I believe there were ATF agents there. All of them were complicit. None of them have ever been charged. None of them have ever been held accountable. Even after the confessions that were extracted were thrown out and the judge declared that they could never be used because they had been extracted under duress and torture, none of these folk were ever held accountable. That should scare you, because if it could happen to them, it happened to you, your children, your grandchildren. I mean, it's the Muslims now. It was the Black Panthers then. It was the African Americans and the Jews in the South being lynched. It could be you. And that's the thing that stays with me all the time. I would like to ask John Bowman to, and Danny, if you would indulge us, ask him to certainly be the, he has a particular message with respect to his experiences in New Orleans, and he was out doing a radio program when we first started. But I'd like to give him an opportunity to take 10 minutes to visit with you about his experience, because he, you know, we'll forgive him for taking a little longer at the radio program. Do you need me to help you get the chair?
No.
Good afternoon. Good evening.
Good evening.
Hello.
Hello.
I was late.
I was at City College doing a radio program called Harlem 411. I don't know if people are familiar with that. Okay.
I was at City College doing a radio program called Harlem 411, and I was being interviewed by a couple of people that wanted to talk about what happened in San Francisco, California, at the federal grand jury, and what happened to me in New Orleans. And so I guess I can just continue this radio interview and this process. I've been in New York since 2 o'clock yesterday, and I've been on two different radio programs, and it's been quite helpful to me to discuss the process that took place in New Orleans and to discuss the process that I'm limited to about the federal grand jury and the process of being subpoenaed and being bought airplane tickets by the Federal Task Force for Anti-Terrorism. You know, they bought me airplane tickets so I could fly to San Francisco and to be put in front of a federal grand jury. Prior to 2003, I had not discussed or engaged in any dialogue or tried to share with people the process that happened in New Orleans, except with my family and my closest friends and a doctor who had to operate on my shoulders because of the corporal punishment. I've had two operations on both of my shoulder blades because that's where a lot of the corporal punishment was paid attention to by the New Orleans police. So I hadn't really discussed it in a public way, in a way that probably I needed to do. And the reason why I didn't do that was because two reasons. One, I didn't think that people would really be sensitive to the information that I would share with people, because it's quite humiliating and it's quite painful to talk about somebody doing corporal punishment on your body when you're butt naked and handcuffed to a chair with your arms behind you and behind your feet shackled to a chair. It's quite painful to do that, and it's humiliating. So that's one of the reasons that I decided that I didn't really want to talk about it. But after being forced to appear in front of a federal grand jury in a room in San Francisco in the federal building with 25 strangers, and none of these people that I know, and I was isolated in a room, and there's a court reporter, and there's a table like this here, and there's the federal prosecutor, there's the state prosecutor, and then over to my left, there's 25 people all staring at me, just looking at me. And then there was a laptop sitting on the table with slides that they were shown about the Black Panther Party and about people in the Black Panther Party and about people who were in the Weather Underground and about people who were associates of the Weather Underground, the Peace and Freedom Party, and all these people were staring at me. I'm sitting in a chair, not handcuffed this time and not naked, but I'm still feeling as if I'm getting ready to be tortured, you know? And I'm looking at these people, and they're looking at me, and I'm taking the Fifth Amendment, I'm taking the 14th Amendment, I'm taking my constitutional rights not to testify or not to answer 35 questions that related to people that I knew in California, people that I knew across the country. And these questions are coming, and I'm taking the Fifth Amendment and other amendments, and I'm feeling like I'm back in New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm feeling like I'm being tortured again. Because the same people who are asking me the questions and the same ones are preparing the questions for the federal prosecutor are the same people who was in New Orleans, Louisiana, the San Francisco police. These police officers, Officer Frank McCoy and Officer Edward Erdelax, they prepared the script to ask the questions. They prepared the whole process. And these are the ones who, I'm sure Mr. Taylor told you, when the questioning was being facilitated and the questions weren't answered, they would usher us back into the room where we were stripped naked and again tortured and asked questions. No questions, I'm sorry, just corporal punishment. So I felt compelled after getting out of jail in October 31st of 2005 for refusing to testify in front of the grand jury. I felt compelled that I could no longer just let this thing be a secret to the world, to the country. My family knew, and my close friends knew all about what happened. But I felt like if I didn't do the right thing in which to just stand up in front of the world and tell the people what happened, that I would continuously be tortured. The torture would go on forever and ever and ever. And this is what the psychologist that I talked with tells me. So that's why I'm here. That's why I'm here in New York. And I'm honored to be able to talk about this in a state of mind that doesn't require me to cry or break down, because it's difficult. But what I want to do is I want to show you some instruments that was used in the 20th century. This is the 21st century, and they use different kind of instruments of torture. You know, like when people are in prison, they use tear gas, they use stun guns, and they isolate people in segregation. They deny people parole after 30 years. So there's different methods of torture in the 21st century. So in the 20th century, I'm just going to share with you what they did to me and the instruments that they used so that you could maybe feel it as personal as I did back in 1973, okay? So what I'm going to do, would you hold? This instrument here is a 21st century cattle prod. When I say 21st century, because back in 1973, it was just a one piece. This piece here, where the batteries are. And this piece on the end, right here, is where you get the electric shock. Okay? But in the 20th century, in 1973, this was just a one piece, and on the end here was a button that they would push, and upon your body, this would be touching your body, and it would send electrical shock. This little box here holds eight batteries, eight double D batteries. The other one in the 20th century, it held a dozen batteries, and it was about this long. So imagine, if you could, it being placed in your anus, being placed under your arms, being placed on your back, any place where there is moisture, which would accelerate the shock. So this is what they did in the 20th century. So in the 21st century, in Guantanamo Bay, there's no telling the sophistication that they have. But I wanted you to just feel as personal as I did when these things was happening to me. So this is called a cattle prod. for people who don't know, this is a cattle prod. This is a 21st century cattle prod. Okay? Would you hand me that blanket? Yeah. This is a blanket, just an ordinary blanket. But this blanket in 1973 was used to, it was put over my head. They would take it out of a wool blanket and I would be sitting in a chair similar to this. Oh, yeah, I can still talk. And I'm handcuffed. The blanket is wet, coming out of a bucket of hot water. I'm handcuffed. I don't have on any clothes. My feet are shackled to the chair. And the cattle prod is being used. And they're beating me across my shoulders, beating me on my knees, and beating me under the bottom of my feet for the purpose of not getting information, but just to terrorize me. Okay? This last piece, this book right here. As I said, I had two operations in 1990s on my shoulder blades because this book, they would use it to slam it on my shoulder blades. It was a much bigger book than this. It's a police ledger. If you ever been into a police station, if you've ever been booked into a police station, there's a ledger, large ledger. So they would take this ledger, it would bust me, hit me on top of the head, hit me across my shoulder blades on both sides. I'm naked. And it was a continuous process over and over and over. And they would take shifts to do this in. And then when they thought it was appropriate time for me to talk to the officers from San Francisco who were the facilitators of the interrogation, they would put some clothes on me. And then I would go into this room. I'm sure Harold mentioned they would go into the room and they would have the tape recorder, they would have the tablet, and the FBI would be sitting in the background. New York, Los Angeles would be sitting in the room. And the officers, McCoy and Erdelax, who are, again, is facilitating the whole process of this new federal grand jury, would ask the questions. And they would ask it in such a way, because they had information collaborated from other people that they was wanting to know about names of people, places, what you did and who did it and who did you do it with and who did those people do it with. Do you know any white people? Do you know white women? Do you know people who participated in acts of murder or aggressive against police officers? So, this was the process that I kept since 1973 until 2005. No, in fact, it was in December 2006. 2005, when we did a presentation in Washington, D.C. at the Trans-Africa Board. That was the first time that I decided to do it publicly because I just thought it was no longer a personal matter anymore. If the Patriot Act and the COINTELPRO Act could be the same, to me it was all the same. So that's why I decided to become part of the Committee to Defend Human Rights, which we decided to do this in October 31st when we were released from the San Francisco County Jail for refusing to participate in the grand jury process. You know? And that's all I have to share.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. On behalf of these brothers and all of the other folk who have had these kind of experiences, and thank you for all of the people in this country whose money pays for all of these abuses and they're kept in the dark. You know, thank you for being here and for expressing, as you've done with your applause, that you feel some of this pain for all of us. If you will indulge us a moment, we started a little bit late and we're supposed to end at 8:30, but there's a couple of things that's developed that I think deserve some attention. First of all, John was a little bit late getting here, and of course, I want to talk a little bit about how we got here. How we got here. In 2003, when these torturers who had been deputized as federal agents, and again, paid for by you, these teams fanned out over the country and started visiting, knocking on the doors. They came to Oklahoma City and knocked on John Bowman's door and said, "Hi, remember us? We're here to visit with you." They went to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and knocked on another brother's door, and they went to Los Angeles, they went to San Francisco, they came to New York. So they spread out all over the country. We were caught off guard. We didn't really expect that this kind of thing would happen on the heels of the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Agency deciding that they were going to go back and clean up, if you will, or target people from 30 years ago for what they believed, was crimes or alleged to be crimes. So we struggled initially with trying to figure out what we could do and how we could get the word out and talk to people to let them know what the hell was going on. And we didn't have, we're all just regular working folks and we're community activists, organizer kinds of folk. And so we didn't have a lot of money. People couldn't hire lawyers. And we didn't really have access to the media. And we had an opportunity, and we were fortunate in that there was a person, in addition to our sister, Jill Sophia Elijah, who graciously stepped to the plate and agreed to work with us to coordinate a legal defense. We needed a way to get the word out and a way to start talking to people, a way to travel, a way to try and get some media savvy so that we could communicate with folk. And we were very fortunate in that there was a man, a brother who has from the beginning in the 70s, 60s, 70s, who came forward then to be a freedom fighter, to declare that he was involved in this struggle for human rights and for civil rights and for freedom for people, for all people worldwide, to be free from oppression and starvation and madness. And so we were fortunate in that we had known this brother who had been a part of what we had been a part of during the 70s and 80s. And we turned to him. And as usual, this beautiful, gallant brother, comrade in arms, who some people see as just a celebrity face or an actor and all of that, we turned to him as brothers and as comrades and went forward and requested his assistance. And he, of course, as he has always done, stepped forward and provided support and provided encouragement. And he's here tonight and to be with us as he has always been. I'm on the program to do closing remarks, but I want to defer to Danny. We're going to have some time for Q&A, some questions from you. But I want to have Danny Glover, our brother, our comrade, your brother and your comrade, and part of the protectors that we all need to have in this society. I want to ask him to do the closing remarks before we have the question and answers. If you will indulge me, because I think it's appropriate that we do that, and then we'll come back and have Q&A. Is that okay? Can we do that? All right, thank you.
Thank you. You know, after listening to John Bowman speak, who I've known for well over 30 years, I've known Hank a long time. I've known Wayne a long time. And the words, the description of their torture is almost numbing. It numbs you because you feel as if you, as he described, John described it, as if you're participating or you're experiencing every blow that he receives, every prod of the cattle prodder that he receives, all the instruments which touch him and which take a bit of his spirit away, touch us in the same way. But it also provides us with the courage to take the next steps. It provides us with the courage to demand the truth. This process of intimidation, which Michael Ratner has talked about, Bill has talked about, Gita has talked about, has a long history to it. That process of intimidation acts in layers. And it begins when people begin to desire and want a legitimate discussion about the real issues. And it begins there. Has nothing to do with the activities that they encounter, activities that they eventually involved in. But they raise the issues in front of us. They raise the truth in front of us. And then they become the bearers of the news. They become the front line. Sometime just a few weeks ago, excuse me, a few months ago, I had a friend of mine talk to me about his mother, who was 75 years old and had retired as a teacher. Occasionally she would go back to this school district where she had taught and offered her services to teach. One time she decided to engage the students in the discussions, a 75-year-old woman volunteering her own time, about the war. Upon doing that, a few weeks later, she was told that it wasn't necessary for her and they did not need her assistance, even though the school district itself had a shortage of teachers. They did not need her. Another form of this layer of intimidation. So it starts all before the actual act, the brutal act. It starts begin to train our minds or condition our minds in such a way. And those that who don't allow their minds to be conditioned are ultimately the ones who are victimized by this. But we're all victimized by it. Every one of you who responded to what John had to say, what Hank has to say, what Harold has to say, every one of you responded in such a way that the only thing that you can do is act right now. The only thing that you do out of your outrage and out of your own pain of listening to this is respond. You cannot let it go. It's unfortunate that we have to hear about John's stories, about the stories of the men and women who were tortured in the prisons around this world in the so-called war on terrorists. It's unfortunate that we have to hear about these stories on the alternative media, in the alternative media, that we have to listen to free speech radio somewhere else to hear these stories. And most times when we listen to these stories, we are by ourselves listening to this story. And we feel somewhat helpless at that particular point because we're simply an individual listening to the radio. But here we are right at this moment, right now, as a collective. Here we are at this moment right now, the beginning of the movement of truth. Here we are now saying that we're going to find our ways to break this silence, this system and structure of fear. We are here to do that. And that is what we are destined to do that. Because whatever we hear, even on the alternative press, is only the tip of the iceberg. We hear nothing from the mass media, but it's only the tip of the iceberg. So it becomes imperative that we act. And only that we here act and move forward and bring others in. And we cannot do anything else other than that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Danny, and I appreciate your indulgence. Some of you have asked how you can help and how you can donate money to the committee. On the back of the brochure that each one of you should have received as you came in, and if you didn't, you may get one as you go out, or there's people here who will make sure you get one. There's an address and a name, and if you write checks, make it out to the Committee for the Defense of Human Rights, or CDHR, and there's also an email address there, too, so you can be in touch with us. So we would ask that you do that, if you're moved to, because as I said earlier, we don't have a lot of money, but we have a story to tell, we have a conscience. The conscience of this nation. We're going to go on the road. We're going to go all over this country and talk to people just as we're doing tonight about what happened, what is happening, and about what we think we ought to do about it. We'll take about 15 minutes, if we can, for questions, Q&A. And what I'd like to do is, if you have a question you want to direct it to someone on the panel specifically, I think this mic will reach, and we're going to try that. Or I'd like to ask you to come up and ask your question, unless you can do it loudly enough for us to hear it. So would you, you're first, you're second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, okay, seven. Okay, first, please. Now, please remember your number, so when I call the number, you will come. Okay. Yes.
Well, this question is for Brother Hank, but he's getting up. Okay, my name's Barbara Cox, and this question is for Brother Hank here. When you were speaking of the grand jury, so it's like in three parts, I wanted to know the number and the racial breakdown. Also, I wanted to know, is there anyone still in jail? And where did your support come from?
Okay, yes. The grand jury was comprised of, I think, 25 people. The racial breakdown of the 25, I think I saw, John can help me with this, wherever he is. John Bowman, where are you? I think I saw maybe two or three blacks on the grand jury, some Asians. Who was indicted? Oh, okay. Oh, okay. No one was indicted. There were no indictments, we were subpoenaed, we refused to cooperate. There were about 23 people, I believe, that were subpoenaed, and I don't remember exactly how, Jill could tell me about how many actually appeared before the grand jury. Almost all of the 23 appeared before a grand jury. Five of us were held in contempt, and five of us independently decided to resist the grand jury, and we were incarcerated.
Okay, number two.
Hi, my name is Clark Kissinger. I guess this question is probably for you, Mr. Thompson, but this was rather ominous, what was described tonight about these torture cops from New Orleans being federally deputized and allowed to go around the country questioning people. Can you explain what a federal agency did that, what the pretext for it was? What's this about?
Yeah, they actually were not from New Orleans. They were former San Francisco Police Department detectives who was a part of who were the coordinators for this
joint task force
back in 73, who were deputized as federal agents by the Department of Homeland Security under the provisions of the Patriot Act. They're not the only ones. There are a lot of federal agents roaming the country who are deputized as special federal agents. These are people that are, National Guard, military police folk, retired city and county police officers. They are being deputized as special federal agents, which allows, of course, them to have jurisdiction all over the country as a part of the Homeland Security Agency. So you're right, it is ominous, very much so, because this is something that we have not seen in the history of this country. I'm told by folk who were in the early 40s that it wasn't quite this bad during World War II, that this is something that's never happened in this country, to the extent that this country has been policed, is being policed by all of these police agents and all of these Homeland Security is every damn thing. These people are everywhere doing everything. Number three. Are you number three? Yes. Okay, somebody want to take that?
I'm going to give you the energy of youth right now. You can... I don't have the wisdom of age, but I'll give you the energy of youth. Yeah, I got wisdom here. You know, for those of you that have busy lives and jobs and are successful, you can financially support the organizations that you see here. The Committee for the Defense of Human Rights is doing tremendous work. The Center for Constitutional Rights is as well. There's many, many organizations that are fighting on the front lines. And that's something very simple. Being able to pick up the phone and call a senator or representative when there's legislation on being considered that you need to weigh in on. It is not enough anymore to talk to your neighbors about it. You need to contact your representative and your senator. Senator Hillary Clinton has not had a good record on the anti-terrorism legislation that's passed. She needs to hear from New Yorkers. You can witness to people who are in prison today. They need letters. You can help preserve a sense of humanity for people whose humanity is being stripped now. You can turn off your television. You can not have your children sit in front of a television. Support independent journalists, independent media that are working hard to get the truth out and to overcome the secrecy, and that means listening to those stations, reading those books, supporting those journalists, and letting your neighbors, your faith community, the people that you work with know about that. Those are a few things I think that are easy along that spectrum for everyone to do, and I think then you can increase your steps. You can get involved and support and become members of organizations. You can invite people to come speak to groups or communities that you can get together. This Riverside Church has welcomed us into their place of worship to be able to have these conversations, and you can go into many environments, your children's school, your PTA group, your own faith community, your civic organizations, and have someone from many of the organizations that are fighting the good fight come and help get other people to do the same things that you're doing.
Hank?
Yeah, I'd just like to add that the Committee for Defense of Human Rights is made up of people who have families and jobs and whatever. But we are willing to sacrifice that time that we are, away from the jobs, families, and whatever's necessary. If you invite us, some of us will come and be happy to do so to, get the truth out. I also want to point out that these were secret federal grand juries. This whole process was secret, under the radar. And the fact that we're doing this is exposing this process. This was going on all over the country.
So, and then one quick follow-up. If you are ready to go to the next step or to be more involved, I have to say that the protesters and the activists that I most admire right now are the Catholic workers who went to Cuba and stood outside the gates of Guantanamo Bay to protest. There are also a group of four individuals from upstate New York who live in Ithaca called the St. Patrick's Day Four who went to pour their own blood on a recruiting center. And although for the record that I'm sure is being made of this speech, I'm not advocating for civil disobedience or for anyone here to break the law, but it is time to make a stand. And I truly respect the individuals who are willing to go out on a line the same way that we as lawyers are doing litigation that is cutting edge. I admire the activists who are taking it to the level I think it needs to be taken to today.
All right. Bill?
Just two things quickly. One is that, as I mentioned before, when I started the Center for Constitutional Rights, we sued the New York Police Department over the operations of the Street Crime Unit. We demanded an end of the Street Crime Unit. And, in fact, we were successful. There is no more Street Crime Unit here in the city of New York. We can do the same thing. We can do the same thing with Guantanamo. No more Guantanamo. Stop it. End it. Shut it down. Write your congressman. That's a simple demand. Point two. The Center for Constitutional Rights has just published a book calling for the impeachment of the President of the United States. Does anyone have a copy of the book they can hold up so people... I guess not. But it's out there. Oh, there's one. Anyway, it's out there. It'll be in bookstores. Right, there's an investigation that is built to sponsor an investigation in Congress sponsored by the most progressive member of Congress, John Conyers. And we can all support that bill. Have your congressman support the bill. Investigate the possibility of impeachment. Have an investigation of impeachment and impeach this president.
Number four. Are you number four? Okay. You're number four.
So your counsel has been there for these men, and there are people like me who the CIA and the NSA have surveilled and who where our dossiers are not the dossiers given over to the FISA court because as a John McCain delegate, the FISA court would reject the Bush administration from surveilling me. But I can help you shut down Guantanamo because as a 9/11 victim, I heard the demolition destroy the U.S. Customs House, which is Sixth World Trade Center. So the abuse that I've suffered being on the front line since the afternoon calling for the impeachment and trials for treason of this administration, I have endured 24/7 electronic, sophisticated electronic surveillance. To speak to the 21st century weapons, the psychotronics is a way by which they will sadistically, psychologically abuse people. And there are the various government intelligence agencies in the Department of Defense use different means and target people differently for different reasons. CIA and NSA, as intelligence, use people like me who work on Wall Street, so they profit off of us. But as also as a 9/11 victim, because I went forward immediately, very few of the 9/11 victims knew what happened, and many have not crossed over into activism because they were ignorant. And people like me who they couldn't cow and they couldn't, you know, abuse and keep us so isolated or away or kill us. But they have kept us from your efforts from liberating these men who have been railroaded and, you know, despicably entrapped and tortured outrageously in Guantanamo for no reason at all. And they will do this to regular Americans because for just their own capricious sociopathic reasons, they've targeted people like me or and have perpetuated this outrageous, vulgar thing like Guantanamo and this global war on terror, which is Homeland Security, $90 billion of pork, Patriot Act, which is outrageous treason. I mean, experts who left the CIA, like Ray McGovern, said, we're a baby step away from Gestapo. And so Americans need to, but my question is, there are those of us who are willing to partner with you. Is there legal counsel? Because I've called the Center for Constitutional Rights for legal counsel because I'm left out on the front line. There's nobody shoulder to shoulder with me. And the CIA and the NSA keep me very isolated.
Oh, I mean, we can't. Thank you very much. You can call and we'll see. We're, as you can tell, we're a small group. And Guantanamo is plenty, and, you know, there's a lot to do.
Some of us can help you.
All right. Well, we have a volunteer program. You can call in and volunteer. Thank you very much.
Number five.
I'm actually here today. My name is Cindy Olson. To give some hope, there's a new campaign called the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. It was just started in January, and really, there's a sleeping giant in this nation. In every temple, in every synagogue, in every parish, every church, and we have every interreligious group signed on. We have the, many participating organizations that are not religious, including the survivors of torture. So I have some information, and we have a website that you can sign on to the petition, but also we have lots of information you can bring back to your communities of faith, especially to have, you know, teach-ins and that sort of thing. So if anyone has any questions, I'm here. I have lots of pamphlets, and thank you very much. And I thank you for bringing this to, you know, Riverside. It's fabulous.
Okay. Number five. You're okay.
Open question to everybody. My name is Darius, and we hear about Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and Hezbollah as terrorist groups. Open question. What is the basic definition of a terrorist? And since the year 2000, where is that terrorist, or what is the mentality of it? If this man said that they showed up at his house in Florida after they tortured him, who, where, what is the mentality of a terrorist? And what do we need to do about it other than just talk?
Open question. All right. Everybody got an open question. Number six? Seven? Seven. You're...
Hi, I'm Saudi Shabazz from the Black Panther Party. My name is Saudi Shabazz from the Black Panther Party, and I actually have two questions. The first question is to the Black Panthers. Have any class action lawsuits been filed by the Black Panthers that were tortured in 1973? And can you give us a little briefing on that?
No, there haven't been. There have been no class action lawsuits.
Why not?
I don't know. That's something to consider, I guess. Yeah.
After 30 years, they came after you, and you haven't considered that? Consider it, brother.
All right.
Question number two. How can the Black Panther Party today go about organizing the black youth and involving them in the human rights struggle?
I think, the Black Panther Party had a program that served the community, that underserved and ignored a segment of our society, the black community. And they proceeded on that basis. They also took the position that we had a right to self-defense, legal, constitutional right to self-defense.
The vanguard that's around now, what can we do to basically tell people about the problems that you have experienced? What can we do to get the word out there to the black masses, the youth?
Call us, we'll come.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right, I think that there were seven questions, so just I want to make an announcement, and then we have Annette from the Center for Constitutional Rights has just one remark she wants to make, and then we'll be winding up. You're all invited to a reception for John Bowman, Harold Taylor, Hank Jones, and Wayne Thompson tonight. At the Uptown Studio, 2035 Second Avenue. It's between 104th and 105th Street. So you're invited. You can come and visit with us tonight. This is set to start around 9 o'clock. So you're all invited. And if all of you don't show up, we'll understand. But we expect to see some of you. Annette, please.
Good evening, everyone. I just wanted to give... all of us an opportunity. As a member of the staff of the center, I am so proud to have had the opportunity to co-sponsor this event with the Committee for the Defense of Human Rights and Riverside Church's Global Justice Ministries. And I just wanted to ask the audience to acknowledge the enormous courage and commitment and candor and dedication that this panel has shown today. It's just remarkable. Thank you. Good night, everyone. Thanks for coming.